Thank you for coming, everyone. We'll have some notes to hand out for those of you who want to take notes. There are several multi-syllable words in this lecture, and I've sought to define a great many of them for you. The material I'm going to be sharing with you is college-level material. Much of it has been adapted from the class that I teach on apologetics at Pacific Bible College. And so I'm going to treat it a bit that way. But what we're going to be talking about is we're going to trace the nature of our thought processes that we find in our culture, what we've all been raised with. We're going to be tracing the history of skepticism, which means tonight we're going to be talking about pre-modern thought and modern thought. And that's going to include most of you in this room. And tomorrow night we'll talk about postmodern thought and how Christians relate to it. We're going to open with something from the Scriptures. We're going to close with something from the Scriptures in each of these times together. And we will hopefully clarify in our minds how best to think, because the thinking that has sufficed in Christian circles for many, many years is now finding itself eaten away. When you look at the condition that our culture is in right now, and you as a Christian begin to share with another person, you might find that they will not ask you whether Christianity is true. They will ask you whether you think it's the only way. And if you think it's the only way, that will bother them a whole lot more than whether or not you think it's true. So as we move through this material, you'll find that a lot of times the ways we have defended the Christian faith in the past need to be adjusted into a little bit of what's going on in our culture right now. So we're going to hopefully cover all of those bases. And then on the last night, we'll talk about some practical ways, questions you can ask of the culture, questions you can ask of friends, and when you get into some debates from time to time, things that would help you hold your own as a Christian. I am convinced it is absolutely imperative that we hold our own as Christians. We must not give away the store. And that means we have to know where the store is, and we have to not just use Christian jargon when we talk to our world. One of the reasons I'm doing this particular seminar is to help us not use Christian jargon, but to actually use words that our world will understand on their own terms, and that we'll be able to say, here's why the way the world thinks is hopeless, because it is utterly hopeless. And that's what we're going to end with tonight. You'll see how hopeless it is and how it got this hopeless. The world is in an utterly hopeless space, and you as a Christian should be able to say, here's why it's hopeless, and here's where the hope can be found, without using just church talk. And we all know the language of church talk, which is perfectly fine for us because we know the jargon, and jargon is useful. It's a shorthand for us. But one of the reasons that we're doing this is to get some of the vocabulary down that is not shorthand for us. So please don't be frustrated when I give you words, like I said, multi-syllable words, words that have to do with philosophy, words that have to do with cultural development. This is all part of not using the Christian jargon and beginning to put things in a way that other people will listen to in our culture. If you brought a Bible, I'd like you to open with me to John chapter 19, John's Gospel chapter 19. Where the Lord Jesus is on trial before Pontius Pilate. The scene, of course, is very, very tense. The Lord Jesus knows what's going to happen. Pilate also knows what's going to happen, but he's trying to get out of it because he knows Jesus is innocent. Blood is everywhere. Sweat is everywhere. There's not a person anywhere within earshot that is anywhere near calm. This is a very tense, brutal scene. But it's a moment, in a sense, of quietness between the Lord Jesus, who is not glowing and does not have a halo, and this man, this crusty, angry, frustrated Roman commander by the name of Pontius Pilate. And as this takes place, I want you to get a feel for what Pilate is thinking when he asks Jesus this famous question that he asks. Begin in verse 33. Pilate entered again into the praetorium, John 18, 33, and he summoned Jesus and he said to him, "You are the King of the Jews?" Because that's what they had said. And Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did somebody else tell you about me?" It's a great line. In other words, is this coming from you, or are you spouting something someone else said? By the way, that's always a good question to ask anybody who asks you about God. You really want to know? Or is this just a rhetorical question? And it's how precise and how alive to the situation Jesus is even at this point in his life, and how clear he is about who he is, and how the difference of the power that Pilate has versus the powerlessness that Jesus has, yet Jesus completely controls the whole thing. It's an amazing scene. Pilate answered and says, "I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation, your chief priests have delivered you up to me. What have you done?" And Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would be fighting that I might not be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." So he's admitting to be a king, but he's admitting to be a king in a way that is not visible. Now, I want you to hold on to this. I want you to grasp what he's talking about. He is talking about something beyond the physical, but it is very, very real. And this comes very much into our discussion this evening and tomorrow night as well. My kingdom is not of this realm. It's not of this age. It's a very real kingdom, but you don't see it yet. Verse 37. Pilate therefore said to him, "So you are a king." And Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king." Pilate doesn't understand it, but Jesus knows he doesn't understand it, but he's going to go ahead and admit to it, even though Pilate's understanding is wrong. Jesus is going to say, "All right, you're right, I'm a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. I came to bear witness of the truth. And everyone who belongs to that truth hears my voice." Now, Pilate did not belong to that truth. And though he heard Jesus' physical voice, he did not hear the voice of Christ the way we know it is meant here. But Pilate asks this crucial question. When he hears Jesus say this, "If you were of the truth, you'd hear my voice," Pilate said, "What is truth? What is truth?" When he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and he said, "I find no guilt in him." It's interesting because it's obviously a rhetorical question for Pilate. He's not asking Jesus what the truth is. Jesus could have told him. I don't know if Pilate said it out of anger because he was so cynical, because he could easily have been cynical. He was a violent man. He was a man who was committed to this age with every fiber of his being. It was all about this age. It was all about what he could do with power, what he had to do for the Roman government, how he could control the Jews. He knew power in this age, but he did not know truth. And so I wonder if there was this cynicism or if he's angry. If Jesus says, "You can know truth," and Pilate says, "What is truth? Ah, what is truth?" Or something like, "What is truth?" Maybe he looked off in the distance over the shoulder of Jesus, out through the stone door, the doorway, and heard the crowds out there and thought to himself, "There is no truth. There's no truth. We are making this up as we go, and it is about survival. And the reason I'm going to have you crucified is because if I don't, I will not survive. They will write back to Caesar, and I will be in trouble for the last time. And so you and I both know, Jesus of Nazareth, that truth doesn't have anything to do with what's going on here right now. What is truth?" That's the question we are about. As Christians, it has always been this question. What is real truth? And it can be capitalized, capital T, truth. What is real truth? The definition of it has changed through the years, at least in our culture. It might interest you to know, and if you're a note taker, now's the time. You'll see where we are, and if you get a little lost, raise your hand. But it might interest you to know that humanity has always wondered about the big questions. This is not a new thing. Anybody with an ounce of reflective thought knows there has got to be more to life than what you see, despite the fact that our culture is telling us that all there is to life is what you see, and they say it to us in our educational systems, and they say it to us in our entertainment industry, and so on. fact of the matter is people ask the big question, and they always have. On a theoretical level, they will ask this: what is ultimate truth or ultimate reality? On a theoretical level, they'll ask the question, what is ultimate truth or ultimate reality? And this dates clear back into the 6th century BC. The Greek philosopher Thales, T-H-A-L-E-S, Thales, was probably the first of the real Greek philosophers. And he said, there's got to be more. I wonder what the ultimate thing is. And from there on, in Greek thought, there was this question, how does this come together? Now, if you remember, the 6th century BC was during the time of the Babylonian captivity. There were a whole bunch of people dealing with capital T truth in another part of the world from where Thales was when he was asking the big question. I just want to remind you that what was going on clear back then was this question: what is truth? What is this all about? On a theoretical level, that's what it is. And we'll define ultimate and the word truth and the word knowledge and all these words that have to be defined these days. We'll define them in just a moment. But then on a practical level, there's a big T truth question, because you cannot live without four answers, answers to four questions. Some of you who have been in my classes know what these four questions are. They are, number one, origins. Where did I come from? Number two, destiny. Where am I going? Number three, meaning. Why am I here? And number four, morality. What is right and wrong? Once again, number one, origins. Where did I come from? This is a list that has been codified really by Ravi Zacharias. But he's not the only one with the list. This is common coin. Everybody knows that they have to ask these questions. Origins, where did I come from? Destiny, where am I going? What happens after I die? Meaning, why am I here? Is it just for my next meal? Is it just for my next thrill? Morality, what is the difference between right and wrong? Will somebody please tell me? And please don't take a vote. And we'll talk about that as we move through the material. Those four questions have got to be answered in the soul of every human being, or they will live with a huge question mark, and they will try and deal with the question mark sometimes by simply self-medication or by trying to find the answers in other ways. Listen, my friend, whatever philosophy you have or whatever philosophy you hear, if it does not answer these four questions, where you came from, where you're going, why you're here, and the difference between right and wrong, it is a bankrupt, runaway philosophy. Period. And that will cover almost all the things you hear at any given time, whether it's in the media or in a classroom or anywhere else. You will hear lots and lots of reasons for living that do not ever address capital T truth. They only address the little things that we can have right now. But a real thinker asks the question, what am I doing here? Where am I going? What's it all about? And they've been asking it for thousands and thousands of years. And that's what Pilate was really asking, even though he was standing right in front of the person who is the truth. It's interesting how close people can be to the truth and look right past what's staring them right in the face. It's interesting, too, that this is a uniquely human, just a sidelight, but this is just a uniquely human idea. No other creature stands around and wonders what life is about. You don't see your dog sitting there, you know, with his paw up here going, I wonder about dogness. But you find humans who wonder about humanness. They want to know what the nature of a human is like. They want to know a big picture. Now, there's a reason why we have this question in our minds, and the reason is because, as we're going to see, we were created by a person who knows all these things. And originally, we had that knowledge. And we don't anymore. But this is what, when we talk about ultimate truth, we are talking about capital T, the real answers, not just in substance, but in morality as well. And so let me give you some definitions. The term ultimate, when I use the term, and when you hear it in this kind of a context, it means the reality, which is the ground of all reality. Ultimate means ultimate, the ground of all reality, something above and beyond what we see. Also known as objective reality. That's another word that is used. Objective reality. The reality which is the ground of everything else. Is there even an ultimate one? We're going to talk about that because the new theories are that there aren't any. B, truth. That which corresponds to objective reality. And we'll see there's a new definition of truth in the field these days too. But here is the real definition of it, the good one. that which corresponds to objective reality, the way the universe really is. In other words, not just something we agree on. Real truth is when you know that what you've said corresponds to what is actually there. When your children come in and you say, "Did you make your bed?" they should not say, "You know, it kind of depends on what you mean by make." You know what you mean by truth, and you know if they lie and they say yes, and you go in there and it looks like a grenade went off, that they lied. That's because they're humans, but aside from that, the reason you know that you want to hear truth is you want their words to actually correspond to an ultimate reality, which in that case means the bed is actually made, though you're in the other room and you don't see the bed made. You want to know that when they say it's made, they're telling the truth, and that means it corresponds to reality. Now, this is pretty common stuff, but you might be interested to know that it is attacked at the most fundamental level right now. That very idea that truth is actual correspondence to ultimate reality is not believed in intellectual circles today, and it's being taught to people that not to believe it, not to look for truth in a correspondence relationship. So when we're here, this is what we're talking about, truth, and we'll see why and how we got to the situation we're in. Knowledge. Knowledge is the ability to know and understand truth about the ultimate. Knowledge means your brain can actually figure something out. I know this may seem very simple to you right now, but this is the level at which the attack against Christianity is happening. Knowledge itself is on the line. So here's a definition of knowledge: the ability to comprehend or understand, capital T, truth about the capital U, ultimate. The implication, of course, when you talk about knowledge is that the human mind is capable of understanding it. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Yeah? Okay. You've got knowledge about truth and about the ultimate. D, language. The reliable ways in which we communicate verbally and in writing. You say, "Well, what? I know that. What are you talking about language? I know what language is." Yeah, you know what language is, but I guarantee you, if you've had a lit course at a secular university, language is a very big deal these days. And that's why the definition of language right here is the reliable ways in which we communicate verbally and in writing. When we speak to one another, we believe that we're hearing what the other person really thinks. Plus, if that person is a truth-telling person, we believe that what they tell us is actual reality, and we put our weight down on it. That means we believe in an objective reality conveyed by a person who spoke to us and or wrote to us, and we can make connections into the invisible, which we cannot see. Okay? Now, the funny thing is that in our culture right now, as we're going to see, language is being attacked at its very ability to convey truth at all. Anybody heard the phrase language games? Well, you will. If you haven't already, you will hear the phrase language games. And it's a reference to the idea that language doesn't really work. Sentences don't really work to convey truth. And what that ends up doing, as we're going to see, is it ends up undermining the whole idea of being able to understand each other. And it especially undermines the idea that you can ever understand a written text. Anything that's been written down. How do you know that's what they meant? How do you know that's what was in the author's mind? How do you know you have what was originally written there? How many times have you quoted the scriptures and had somebody roll their eyes and say, "Well, how do you know?" Okay. You know, there's a lot of people that don't have multi-syllable words in their vocabulary, but they certainly have a postmodern view of language and truth. And so we'll see a little bit more about that. Epistemology, I told you some big words are coming. Epistemology is the science of knowing how we know what we know, and especially things about truth and ultimacy. For instance, let me ask you a question. Do you know the things you know because you learned them in words? Or did you know something before you learned any words? Do you have children? Do children learn with words? Or do they know before you say something to them? How does a baby know to crawl in a straight line towards something it wants? Did someone sit down and say, "You know, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. I want you to memorize this, honey. And stop crawling in circles. If you want a cookie, you crawl across over here." My little granddaughter, Alyssa, when she would hear the dog bark, their dog, Max, she would crawl in a straight line right through two open doors. She'd push the door open to get to the other room. "Max, Max," and she would crawl in. to that room. How do babies know this kind of stuff? How do you learn? Do you learn just with words? Or is there such a thing as innate knowledge? Do you discover things you already knew and just find words for them? Well, this is all about epistemology. In a recent Newsweek article, there was a thing about how babies learn. Did anybody see that? The cover of it has a baby with a whole bunch of stuff stuck to its little head. And on the inside, it's an article about how babies learn things. This is all about epistemology and how we know what we know and how we know it's true, whether it's by intuition. Do you trust intuition? Do you think intuition is a real thing? Some people don't. And here's the final definition, metaphysics. This is the branch of thought that deals with issues beyond the physical, beyond physics. It examines the nature of reality, including the relationships between mind and matter, between substance and attribute, between fact and value. What's the difference between a fact and a value? Is a value the same as a fact? When you walk into an educational institution and they have their core values written on a little plaque, are those core facts or can they be changed? And how did they arrive at those? Are they seen as facts? And what's the relationship between them? What's the relationship between the immaterial and the material? Can the material ever understand the immaterial? This is all metaphysics. And some of you are thinking to yourself, why did I come so early to get a seat here? This is heavy stuff. It is heavy stuff. It is heavy stuff. And I wish I could make it lighter, but if you don't understand that this is where the attack is, then you will simply shake your head and walk away from your culture. Don't do it. How often have you heard a person say, without any metaphysical, epistemological language, have you ever heard them say, well, that's just your interpretation? Okay. Well, that's an epistemological metaphysical statement. Do you want to have an answer for them when they say, well, that's just your interpretation? And you know, we just stand there and go, well, I guess it is. And we don't stop and actually try this next time someone says that. Tell them, you know, that's an epistemological statement. And it's very metaphysical. So there. And they'll look at you like, really? What did I mean? Well, that's why you're here, so that you can answer that question. What did I mean when I said it's just your interpretation? Well, see, we deal with this all the time. We just don't use the big words. So here's what I want for this group. I want us to get used to big words and stop running away from them and stop running away from big ideas. Your brain is as good as anybody else's. And there's every reason in the world for you to say, I can understand this. It's really, believe it or not, once you get past the multisyllable words, it's not that complex. It's trying to figure out, and it's what they've always tried to figure out, what's the relation of the material to the immaterial? How is it that my mind is connected to my body? How is it that when in my spirit I want to move my hand, it moves? That's what they were asking, and that is a very good question. And what happens when I die? And how come I can tell the difference between a person who's sleeping and a person who's dead? What's missing? What is the immaterial about? Where did we come from? Stuff or a mind? Which one was first and how do they relate to each other? See, this is all about metaphysics. And this is really where Christians are, believe it or not. All philosophy addresses itself to metaphysical issues. And so does religion. There's a very fine line between religion and philosophy. You are a metaphysician if you're a Christian thinker. The only question is whether you're a good one. The only question is whether your metaphysical thinking is the same as the Lord's metaphysical thinking. Whether you believe there is an objective truth out there, whether you believe you understand very much about it, or if you're just making stuff up. So that's what we're about. And as we work through this, I think we will see some answers for our world. Incidentally, the Lord Jesus had a great deal to say about this. When you really look at the way he came to his people, he was always talking to them about how they think and what the nature of their faith is. We'll see that those two things are intimately connected to each other. So let's talk about a brief history of truth and knowledge in the West. How did we get to where we are today when another recent article in one of the national news magazines finds President Bush in hot water, again, as usual, for saying something right? He got in a lot of trouble for saying intelligent design is a good thing and ought to be taught in the classrooms. Remember that just recently? And so, oh man, everybody's getting into it, you know, and oh, it's not really science and yada, yada, yada. How can a president of the United States of America get in trouble for simply saying maybe we ought to think that perhaps, just possibly, there's a mind that accounts for all this complexity? And that's all that intelligent design is saying. And he even brings up the topic and all of a sudden, boom, everything's exploding all over the place. How did we get to that point? That would have been not that long ago, less than, well, probably one generation ago, it would not have raised any eyebrows at all. Eisenhower put the phrase "under God" into the Pledge of Allegiance, and it did not cause a little bit of problem in the mid-1950s. And today, you even imply that God might have had something to do with anything or has any metaphysical reality, and suddenly you're in trouble. How did we get there? Well, let's talk. Usually the best way to organize thought in the West is divide it up in three sections. And I talked about this last year at the last night we were together. And there were so many questions about it that I decided to actually build on that and spend three nights talking about pre-modernism, modernism, and postmodernism and the answers to the questions that they raise. Generally speaking, you can divide up history, and especially in Western thought, into three areas: pre-modernism, modernism, and postmodernism. And I'll give you the dates as we move along through it. Pre-modernism, from antiquity roughly to the 18th century. And let me point out, and there's a little paragraph there that I gave you already, but the transitions between these periods of time are very loose transitions. At any given time, you'll find people from basically the previous mindset that are all right here, and also some people with the new mindset that are all in the same room. So it's not like there was one date after that everybody was modern, and before that everyone was pre-modern. There's a real kind of, anybody remember the old Chevy slush-o-matic transmissions that would go from first to second to third? You never were quite sure which gear it was in, which is kind of, and then you're in the next gear. Remember those? Some of you guys remember those, slush-o-matics. That's the way this works. So these transitions, when I say roughly from here to here, that's all I'm talking about. And these are trends in thinking. They're the way people tend to view reality, and it's almost always idolatrous in a fallen world. So as you see the trends, don't get too uptight about specific dates. But we're talking in pre-modern thinking, roughly from antiquity into the 18th century. And here's the motto, and you can fill in the blanks. Here's the motto of that period of time, kind of capitalizes what would have been thought. God, whether personal or multiple or impersonal, okay, we're talking about all thinking in those days, supplies order. We see order, we see life, we see stuff in some organized fashion. The rain falls, stuff grows. There must be something out there. So whatever it is, it supplies this order. This was pre-modern thinking. The cosmos mystifies us. That's what they would think. Look at this, is an amazing thing. Look at the cosmos. Look at the world. It is amazing to me. The cosmos mystifies us. There must be someone or something out there, and if we pay attention, we can understand. This is pre-modern. Prior to the 18th century, common across the globe for the most part, with a few exceptions, but for the most part, we can understand him or them or it. Now, I say all of that because I'm talking about everybody now. I'm not just talking about, you know, Hebrew prophets. We're talking about everybody in the world. Pre-modernity would say God supplies order. The cosmos mystifies us. There must be someone or something out there. If we pay attention, we can understand. Let's try and pay attention. Let's try and figure it out. Ultimate truth and knowledge were available and desirable. This changes, as you're going to see, when we get into postmodernism. But ultimate truth and knowledge were available and desirable in conjunction with the metaphysical or the supernatural. In other words, people said, we'll buy into this. We think there is something supernatural out there. Or at least metaphysical, at least something beyond what we can see. It was understood in human history up until the 18th century. Now, that's not that long ago. And look at all of human history. It was understood widely that there was something out there we didn't understand. Truth was considered to be that which corresponded to reality, just like I just said. A correspondence view of truth. They didn't neglect the intellect. People think, oh, pre-modern, these people were all silly and superstitious. No, there was superstition, but some of the great thinkers lived during that period, and I'll give you some of their names in a minute. Knowledge of truth and reality was considered possible. You could actually get there from here. You could learn things. But generally, it was dependent on either some form of revelation or theoretical thought. You went and you learned from people who had given it a lot of thought. You didn't just watch Oprah. You learned from people who gave it a lot of thought, or you believed God had spoken in some way. But you knew beyond a shadow of a doubt something was out there. This is intuitive, by the way. The scripture says it's intuitive to the human mind to know that there's something else out there. This is pre-modern. Now, theistic thinkers, under number two there, theistic thinkers sought the truth and reality within the framework of a personal God, obviously. But non-theistic thinkers, like the Greek philosophers, they sought the same kind of truth from some impersonal something or other. But they still were looking beyond the physical. That's what's going to change. B, the universe was considered open. Can someone tell me what an open universe is? You've heard the difference between an open universe and a closed universe, yes? Have you ever heard that? Okay, well, let me tell you. An open universe is a universe in which the supernatural can happen. That's an open universe. And they believed in an open universe. Almost everybody did. That the universe was, in fact, they believed it was pretty wide open. They thought there was a lot of stuff going on. Sometimes that wasn't. They did not have the idea that miracles couldn't happen. They believed that because there was something big out there, that therefore it was a somewhat open universe. And sometimes they believed it was wide open. Number one, belief in the supernatural was axiomatic. That's another good word to throw into a conversation. You're going to get a lot of good words for the coffee shop. Axiomatic means self-evident or universally recognized, and it was. You can remember polytheism, monotheism, all of the isms, lots of isms from back then. They all believed that the supernatural was there. They had different definitions for it. But they saw up until the, and catch this, that means for most, the vast majority of human history in terms of years has always believed in some reality beyond what you could see and has believed that the universe was open and that a miracle could happen. It's only been in the last 300 or 400 years that that began to shift. The 1700s through right now. So we're really in a minority, though you've been raised with the idea that that doesn't happen. And in the Christian community, you had to reorient yourself once you began to think about the Lord. Now we're also finding, as we're going to see, part of our culture is really diving into Spiritism after years and years of being told that it can't happen. But in the pre-modern world, that's the way it was. The universe was considered open, sometimes wide open. Number two, skepticism was represented but not mainstream. And I gave you the definition of skepticism. Skepticism is the theory of knowledge that denies any possibility of complete or genuine knowledge of any objective world, the world that's out there. Real knowledge, accurate knowledge of the real is impossible, according to skeptics. Even our immediate apprehension of things is not certain or accurate. I gave you this, right? Okay. Usually, this denies the possibility of knowing the ultimate reality of things because all we have to go on is our perceptions, which may or may not be accurate and can't be tested. That's the definition of skepticism. Remember it. In the ancient times, this was very much a minority report. There was a guy by the name of Protagoras who kind of used to go around in the BC days, and he would poke fun at all the philosophers, and he would say, you guys don't know anything. How do you know that? And he was a radical skeptic. It's interesting because you know what his motto was? Man is the measure of everything. He was the person who had the motto and made it famous. Homo mensura, man is the measure. In other words, what he was saying was, we make this up, you guys. Now, that was very much a minority report, but as we work through this, what we're going to find is that actual feeling began to grow more and more and more as time went by. But the vast majority of people in the pre-modern world believed in an open universe, and though they were not godly, the majority, they did believe something could happen. Eastern religions all believed in some way in the supernatural. Hinduism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, that's a Persian religion, Confucianism, all of them. They all believed in something metaphysically beyond what you could see here. The Hebrew prophets put the dates down from 1500 BC through Malachi, 5th century, around 445 BC. The Hebrew prophets were really speaking truth. And it's interesting because their words were known outside the Hebrew world. Because people were thinking, what is ultimate reality about? And the Hebrew prophet said, we will tell you, he has a name. But it wasn't the majority report. You've got the Greek thinkers, secular Greek thinkers. Can anybody think of famous Greek philosopher names? Socrates, yeah. Who else? Who was his famous? Plato. Who was his famous student? Aristotle. You got the three biggies. Socrates, 470 to 399. Plato, from 428 to 347. Just remember that they were in the 5th century and the 4th century B.C. Aristotle, 4th century B.C. And they were thinking a lot. Did you know, by the way, that Socrates, we only know about Socrates because Plato, his student, wrote some stuff. But did you know that he was forced to drink hemlock? You know what his crime was? That's how they executed people. They made him drink poison. You know what his crime was? He rejected the mythology of the Greek pantheism. And he said, I think maybe there's only one God. And they made him drink poison. And do you know why? Because the society in which he lived, which was the Greek society, thought that that would undermine the morals of the youth. I kid you not. He was undermining the morals of the youth by telling them maybe Zeus isn't it. And we're all going, well, Socrates, maybe we'll see him in heaven. Don't jump to that conclusion. We're not sure about that. Because he believed in an impersonal God, but at least he was looking out there. This pre-modern period was not stupid. They actually, in a lot of ways, thought much more brightly about things than many people in our own era. Plato, Aristotle. Aristotle's responsible for, or people believe he's responsible for inventing logic. He really just discovered it. And most of what we call logic comes from Aristotle. He was also the tutor for Alexander the Great. And that's how Aristotelian thought got spread throughout the world. Alexander the Great took it. Aristotle was his tutor. A man by the name of Plotinus, you probably don't know his name, P-L-O-T-I-N-U-S, and he lived after the coming of Christ. But his philosophy is known as Neoplatonism, had a huge impact, still does to this day. It's at the heart of Gnosticism. And when you go to Ashland and you see little charts, Ashland or San Francisco or my hometown, Santa Cruz. You don't see a lot of these in Shady Cove. But little poster that says, come and learn about Gnosticism, the mystic religion that was held down by Christianity. Okay. The Da Vinci Code. You guys heard of the Da Vinci Code? One of the main things behind the Da Vinci Code is Gnostic literature. It traces its origins to Neoplatonism. The father of Neoplatonism is Plotinus. These thinkers had ideas that affect you today, this very day, and that make money for novelists who write philosophy in their novels. So Greek secular thinkers dating clear back into that period, also Christian thinkers. Can you think of some important Christian thinkers from the pre-modern period? Before the 18th century, important Christian thinkers. Martin Luther, he was in the Reformation. Go further back. Augustine, did I hear the word Augustine or Augustine? Josephus was not a Christian. He was a historian. How about the name Anselm? Anybody heard the name Anselm? First Archbishop of Canterbury. Awesome thinker. Thomas Aquinas. Write those three names down, Augustine, Anselm, and Aquinas, A-Q-U-I-N-A-S. These guys were philosophically and religiously, theologically, pretty much geniuses. And though you might not agree with everything they said, they shaped Western thought. All of this happened prior to the 18th century, back in pre-modern, dark ages. Augustine, Anselm, A-N-S-E-L-M, Aquinas, A-Q-U-I-N-A-S, Thomas Aquinas. What I'm trying to get across here is that the pre-modern period was not stupid, that was not dark ages. There was a lot of great thinking going on and a lot of thinking that affects your thinking to this day. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, you know what? I'm kind of a pre-modern because what you described is kind of the way I think. How many of you thought that when I said that? And you're thinking, I don't want to admit I'm pre-modern. Good grief. Am I old-fashioned? Yes, you are. As we're going to see, though, premodernism did have some problems. Christian theism, see, Christian theism generally reigned in Western Europe from the 5th to the 17th century. And I gave you a little paragraph there. During the period from the early Middle Ages to the end of the 17th century, very few people challenged the existence of God or held that ultimate reality was impersonal or that death meant individual extinction. The reason was obvious. Christianity had so penetrated the Western world that whether people believed in Christ or acted as Christians should, they all lived in a context of ideas influenced and informed by the Christian faith. In the Western world, for better or for worse, and you can say, well, the church did a lot of bad things during the Middle Ages, and they did do some bad things during the Middle Ages for a lot of bad reasons. But for better or for worse, Christian thought and the idea that a real God was there who'd really spoken, this was part of life. And even if you were an atheist, you did not let on. And even if you didn't believe as a real believer in those days, you lived as though there would be a time when you would be judged for your actions. That's changed. But it was very much the case into the 17th century and even beyond that, but it started to shift. Here are two of the main issues. Truth was ultimate reality and it was revealed to us by God. That was the way they thought. In other words, the emphasis was on understanding God's world. And when you figured something out, you said, wow, the Lord made it that way, and he let me figure it out. You did not come at it and say, look, this happened by accident. Now that we figured it out, we've proven that there is no God. You didn't say that. You came at it from the standpoint of saying, you know what? The Lord has done this. And so I'm learning to understand God's world. That's why most of the early, what we call scientists, were theists. They believed in God, and they thought they were just figuring out what God had done, thinking God's thoughts after him. Secondly, notice that knowledge was seen as discovering what God already knew. Now let that soak in. Knowledge was considered as discovering what God already knew. That means without God, you couldn't know anything. That was the way they thought. Right now, you can start thinking, well, wait a minute, that's not what I was taught in biology class. And you're absolutely right. It's not what you would be taught in biology class today either. Knowledge was seen as discovering what God already knew, which meant that reason, and write this down, reason was the handmaid of faith. It was faith seeking understanding. Reason was faith seeking understanding. These people started with God. They said, I want to know what God has to say. Christian thinkers used their reason to understand their faith. And even though they interacted with the pagan thinkers, and they did, some of the best writing was interacting with pagan thinkers, they started with God. Now, D, but premodernism, with its too open universe, spawned a huge amount of superstition. And this is what you hear a lot about. And there was quite a bit of superstition and mysticism and silliness, even in the church, during that premodern period, because people speculated a lot and didn't critique hardly anything that they heard. Almost anything they heard, they believed, and they had no way of evaluating it, even among Christians. Can anybody tell me why that might have been at that particular period of time, even among Christians? They might not have had a way of evaluating. Lack of a Bible, exactly. And not only lack of a Bible in those days, but there was, even if you had the scriptures, what we take for granted, especially as Protestants, is that you can appeal to the scriptures and find out truth about God. And they did not have that in as clear a way. And so there was a lot of mysticism, kind of muddled mysticism in those days. And so it got kind of wacko. Plus, there was a lot of political stuff. You ever heard about all the political wrangling in the Dark Ages with the church and all that stuff? And people just got sick and tired of it. And around the 14th to the 17th century, the Renaissance. Is that written in there for you? R-E-N-A-I-S-S-A-N-C-E. Renaissance. Renaissance. R-E-N-A-I-S-S-A-N-C-E, 14th to the 17th centuries. People started to connect. Now get this, because this is very, very important. they began to connect with why do we think what we think? Let's go back to some of the original stuff we've learned. Has anybody read any of the Greek classics lately? Which they hadn't. Does anybody know where we could find anything in Greek from the New Testament? And they began to say, well, you know what? We have Greek New Testament documents. Let's put them together. Let's start thinking about them. So you got Christians who started thinking this, and they're saying, let's get away from some of the senseless stuff we've been told, and let's find out what was really written originally. And during this period of time, there was this rush of, hey, let's figure it out. Let's find out. And that's a good thing, but it started to go haywire. Can anybody think of why? Who... If you didn't want to believe in God, who could you read that would help you not believe in ultimate truth in God? Do you remember the Greeks who were skeptics? Well, what happened was people began to read and they went a little too far. And some of them said, look, we're sick of everything, including God. We think everything the church has ever said is wrong. We're going to throw everything out, the baby and the bathwater. And they began to read the skeptics heavily and began to question all kinds of things. And so what happened is, instead of just simply awakening to getting back to the original things and being a little bit critical about the mysticism and this wide open universe that they had, they actually became very critical of everything. And that thought progressed and got worse and worse. And we'll see that it actually got into the modernistic thing. Let's move into modernism. Roughly 18th to the 20th century, here's their motto. We can find order without God. Now there's a shift. The thinking goes, first, there must be something out there. Now it's, oh no, wait a minute. We can use our minds. We can start finding order without God. The cosmos now interests us. It used to be the cosmos mystifies us. Now the cosmos interests us. There must be some big concepts out there that we can find without God's help. Anybody watch the X-Files? What was the motto in the X-Files? They would write it every time. The truth is out there. That is modernism. The truth is out there. We can apply ourselves and we can find it. But we do not need God. Incidentally, a lot of this stuff comes out. We see... Do you remember the X-Files? Anybody watch the X-Files? I watched it for theological value. It's the same reason, I watched Star Trek. The two main characters in the X-Files, one believed in stuff they didn't see and the other one was a complete rationalist. The man was the one who was saying, Mulder, he was always saying, you know, the truth is out there. It's got to be. I know there's more out there. And Scully, the woman... who was the doctor and the scientist, was always saying no. And it was the tension between the person who believed in stuff he didn't see and the person who said, I won't believe it till I see it. It was that tension that kept the show going. Because you were seeing just enough of it to say, yeah. Do you know why that strikes a big chord with people? It's because it's a metaphysical epistemological question. Truly. Truly, see, we're all a bunch of metaphysicians. And smart movie makers know that. Did anybody see Batman, the recent one? Batman Begins? Nobody saw that? Well, you didn't hear it from me. I don't make recommendations, but if I had seen it, I would have noticed that it was better than any of the other Batman movies. And do you know why it was better than any of the other Batman movies? I mean, remember, we're talking movies. We're not talking good in the first place, but... It was a better movie because of the philosophical overtones in it. Huge philosophical overtones. The difference between vengeance and justice is explored, actually, in the movie. And the personal tension that is involved between vengeance and justice. You say, good grief, you went to a Batman movie and saw philosophy. Yes, yes, because there is philosophy and theology, brothers and sisters, everywhere. Once you start looking for it, and you must. You say, every movie and every book and every comic strip is a parable, and it is telling you a worldview and a philosophical story. You've got to look for it and ask yourself, what is the worldview and the philosophical story in this piece of literature? Critique it. and ask the questions. When we get into modernism, we see very clearly that the shift in human thinking was now moving, and we're moving into now into an era in which you and I find our roots. Modernity is said to be the worldview characterized by an emphasis upon the capacity of reason to uncover universal truths. Truth is out there. The rejection of superstition and religious authoritarianism, an understanding of science as producing ever more accurate pictures of the universe and the human person, an expectation that science and technology and education working together without God, remember, will eradicate problems and progressively improve human life, and a general toleration for various creeds and ways of life. Now look at this, so long as they do not conflict with what reason sanctions, the supremacy of the human. Ultimate truth and knowledge, what would they say about that in the modern period? It is available and desirable. Ultimate truth and knowledge. Now, we're still in a period where you can find it. Ultimate truth and knowledge available and desirable, specifically without metaphysics or supernatural. That's the big difference. They still thought there was big stuff out there to learn. But now the difference is not we think that big stuff is metaphysical and it might be God. Now, we know that big stuff can be figured out by us. Available and desirable, but without metaphysics or the supernatural. And that meant God. That meant the Christian God. By the time you see the dates, 18th to the 20th century, that means the 1700s through the 20th century when we were all born and raised. We are the recipients of this mindset right here, and you'll recognize it as we start to describe it. Truth was considered that which corresponds to reality. Okay, so far it's the same. And it was considered universal, by the way. Once you found a truth, it was true everywhere at all times. If something was true here in the United States, really and truly true, like gravity, well, then it would be true in China 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. A truth is a truth is a truth, and it is universal. And that was the way it was understood. Secondly, knowledge of reality was possible. It was desirable and promised a rosy future. These folks were excited about the future. We figured out all kinds of stuff. And they were learning so much. The growth curve during the modern period was really rising. They were picking up by the 1800s. They had figured out electricity and all kinds of stuff. Boy, if they knew where we were today, they would be flipping out. Very optimistic view. Number three, there's a little blank spot next to number three. Write this down. But neither truth nor knowledge were rooted in any way in God. They were separate. Now catch this. Neither truth nor knowledge were rooted in any way in God. They were completely separate. You must grasp this shift because it's what you were raised in. Real truth and real knowledge can be acquired by the human mind apart from God and should be acquired that way. Is the where this is going to go. Real truth in the modern period could be found, but it was not about God and you didn't need God. In fact, if you believed in revelation from God, you were really goofing it up. You were not making good sense with it. You needed to do something completely apart from God. Listen to this. This is an eyewitness report from November 10th, 1793, late 18th century. 1793, in Paris, France, at the Cathedral of Notre Dame. November 10th, 1793, on this particular morning, says this man in his journal, there took place in the Cathedral of Notre Dame of Paris an extraordinary religious event. This was the Festival of Liberty and Reason, proclaimed 3 days before by the mayor of the city. And this is after the French Revolution. As spectators, officials of the Commune and the Department of Paris, together with a great concourse of plain citizens, entered the cathedral, and they saw, some doubtless with astonishment, the insignia of Christianity, all the symbols of Christianity, covered up, and their place taken by the symbols of a strange new religion. Rising up in the nave, that's the outer part of the church there, was an improvised mountain, at the top of which perched a small Greek temple dedicated to, quote, philosophy, and adorned on both sides by the busts of philosophers. probably Voltaire, Rousseau, Franklin, and Montesquieu. Halfway down the side of the mountain, a torch of truth burned before an altar of reason. Now, this is in Notre Dame Cathedral. They covered up the cross. They covered up anything to do with Christianity. They built this mountain here in this thing. The torch of truth before the altar of reason. And then ensued, he says, a bizarre ceremony which culminated in the emergence from the temple of a beautiful woman, an actress of the Paris Opera, dressed in red, white, and blue, who personified liberty. The spectators proceeded to render homage to liberty by stretching out their arms and singing a hymn, the words of which were written by Marie Chenier. Quote, "Come, holy liberty, inhabit this temple, become the goddess of the French people," end quote. Soon thereafter, the Constitutional Convention decreed that Notre Dame should be known as the Temple of Reason. 1790s. Do the colors red, white, and blue bother anybody? And the woman standing there with the torch, worshiping liberty, right at the same time that our nation was forging its identity, this ought to ring a very big liberty bell in everybody's mind, because I guarantee you that thinking was very much a part of the beginning of our own nation, despite the fact that at the grassroots level, vast numbers of people were genuine Christians. Look at what was happening in the minds of Europe, and what was also happening, one of the great minds was Benjamin Franklin, who was one of the guys back and forth. He had like an open ticket to France, back and forth and back. They loved him. Enlightenment, rationalistic reason, and the worship of the human mind was very, very powerful in the elite circles at the time that our nation was born.